This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana, originating from the Investar Bank building in Baton Rouge, the Investar Tower. And we're going to spend the first half of our show today with Ted James, a former state lawmaker. He served a decade in the Louisiana House of Representatives, District 101. And then he went to work for the Small Business Association as the regional administrator for Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. He resigned his post in January of this year and began a quest for mayor-president. The election is 12 weeks from today, as in 84 days, and Ted James is, of course, a serious candidate, and he is trying to unseat the incumbent, Sharon Weston Broom, a person he supported heartily in the past, but now he is trying to get the job. And there are those, I'm out in the community in this battle of Democrats, and there are three Republicans in the race, and we'll talk about them as well. But they say that some people say Ted ought to wait 4 years, and others say Sharon said she was only going to do two terms. I suspect you're with the latter group, but did you try to come together on this, or did you just say, look, it's my time and your time is over? What's the thought process?
You know, Jim, thank you for having me on. And the mayor and I have had conversations about this moment over the years. I still consider, you know, her a friend and an ally. We just have a difference of opinion about where Baton Rouge is and where Baton Rouge should be. Now, I did give her the courtesy that she deserves. And we had this conversation in March of last year and again in December. And for me, the wait your turn, that's always put on younger folks when they are attempting to do what's in their heart. And for me, this is not a rushed decision. It's a decision that you remember I almost made 8 years ago. So for those that are saying, Ted should wait, honestly, Ted has waited. I've waited 8 years, and I didn't sit on the sideline and pout. I worked with the mayor's her administration. I believe that when she needed things in the legislature, I was the first person she called. And here we are at this moment of time. And for me as a parent, I have a different responsibility to Baton Rouge and my experience in the federal government. As I've watched other communities soar, and I believe that Baton Rouge is stagnant. And, you know, of course, I can't say that I would have wished that the mayor had not run, because I support her doing what she believes is in her heart. But for me, I had to make the decision that my relationship with Baton Rouge trumped my relationship with Sharon Weston Broom.
877-217-5757 for Ted James, who is a serious candidate. Michael Baychok, the political advisor to the mayor, was on our show last week, and he acknowledged that a runoff is likely, and that, in his view, the runoff will be with Sid Edwards. What do you know about this man, and do you view him as a threat to edge you out of the number two slot, or maybe even the number one slot? I guess in that case he would be edging out Mayor Broom, but the conventional wisdom is that the two Democrats may make the runoff this time. What is your thinking on that?
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Baychok on one thing. We're certainly going to a runoff. I disagree with him because I certainly intend to be in that runoff. And I don't know Mr. Edwards. He and I did talk on the phone once, and I look forward to personally meeting him. But this race is between Ted James and Sharon Weston Broom. The numbers suggest it. The polling suggests it. And Mr. Baychok knows it. That's why he spends a lot more time talking about me than talking about the issues in East Baton Rouge Parish. And he is someone who I think I still consider him a friend today, but that may change before November.
He's a great guy, but as you know, in politics, all is fair in love and war.
That's right.
in politics. But if I were advising you, I would certainly you're running because you think you can do better than the incumbent. And I remember a time when people would actually run for office and say, so-and-so did a good job, I just think I can do a better job. But now it's not the case. We tend to point at flaws or perceived flaws. But I also would keep an eye on Coach Edwards, who has a great reputation. And he's a first-time candidate, but the Republican vote is significant. It's not a majority. And he is all but been endorsed by Woody Jenkins and his crew as the Republican. But this noise in the background about his lack of voting, is that a real issue?
Yeah, I think it is a real issue for, you know, someone who's seeking to ascend to this position and hasn't voted. And, you know, I think it's since 2015 from what I've heard. But, you know, also think that there are some folks that
hasn't voted since 2015.
Since 2015 from, you know, all the accounts that I've received about Coach Edwards. But, you know, for me, it's something in his heart pushed him to run for office, and maybe sitting on the sideline was the reason why, right? Maybe he was disengaged because he was so busy coaching football. And for me, it's what does he bring to the table? And I believe that if all of the candidates were if they played quarterback for a team that the coach was leading, I don't think that he would start himself over me, right?
Well,
but you know,
Tracy of the Capitol said he was waiting to vote for the right candidate himself.
You know, maybe so. That's you know, Tracy, that may be the issue. But you know, in this dynamic with this race at this time, I believe the voters will consider the candidate that has the diversity of experience to lead this parish in the difficult times. You know, I wouldn't discount the other candidates, Mr. Myers, who has run for office several times and has a base, and Nathaniel Hearn, who I haven't met, but, you know, a younger, fresh voice. So I don't, you know, just assume that because Woody is walking Coach Edwards around that he's going to walk away with the Republican support.
We do have three viable Republicans. Steve Myers is a multimillionaire real estate guy, founder of Tiger Rag, and Nathaniel Hearn's an impressive guy, hangs out at Louis a lot, a young lawyer, and I think he's got Roy Fletcher running his campaign, so he's a legitimate candidate. The other day at Louis, Collis Temple and I had our napkins on predictions, and I predicted a runoff with you and Sharon Broom, and I also predicted that she would run first in the primary and you would run second. But he had it Broom 48, Edwards 30, and you at 28, and I don't think the numbers actually work that way because that's over 100%.
Yeah.
You can't get over. But it could break out that way because last time we had two Democrats running in Sharon Weston Broom and Denise Marcel, and collectively they got 55% of the votes, and that left 45% for the other candidates.
Yep.
Now, if that were to happen this time, Edwards would make the runoff. But do you think you can appeal to voters in the white business community?
I already have. And nothing against, you know, prior candidates. But Sharon Weston Broom has never run against Ted James. So the numbers in 2020 and the numbers in 2016 aren't as significant to me because she hasn't faced a candidate with the level of experience that I bring. Now, crossover, the person that's going to win this race, you remember you pointed out, and many people point out, that I've supported the mayor. So I've been in rooms with the mayor during campaigns in previous years. I know that the person that's going to win this race is the person that will be able to garner some crossover. And my fundraising shows that from the business community. Once I roll out endorsements, we will see a high number of Republicans who are currently in office and previously served in this office who are supporting Ted. And that 48% that I know the mayor received in 2020, mm-hmm. that's not happening in 2024.
Well, presumably people like Lane Grigsby and Eddie Risponi will go in the booth on November 5th, and they'll vote for Donald Trump, and then they'll vote for Ted James. How does that square?
You know, I think that when we look at national politics versus what's happening in local government is about getting the basics, right? Fire and safety, mm-hmm. infrastructure, basic city services. And when you look at East Baton Rouge Parish over the last 8 years, Republicans and Democrats alike can count. And what's happening is over the last 7 years, we've exceeded 100 murders all but once under this administration. If you live in North Baton Rouge, you can see that the trash isn't getting picked up. You can see that the grass isn't getting cut. Republicans and Democrats alike are losing young people in droves because young people are choosing opportunity over Baton Rouge. And that's not a national issue. It's a local issue. Well, and I believe that folks are going to focus on those.
Well, some of this is, of course, a budget issue. You can only do so much with so much. But what about St. George? Added a new wrinkle, a big one.
A big one. And one of the things about budgets, one of my criticisms is we have to learn how to grow the budget by being very aggressive and pulling down our tax dollars out of the state capitol and from D.C. And this administration, in my opinion, has not done a good enough job of being able to take care of critical services, but also make large investments by way of having an aggressive agenda at the state capitol, which I will have working with our delegation. When you look at our infrastructure, we have so many different Baton Rouge is in such a prominent position in over the past 4 years with our relationships with Cedric Richmond, Mitch Landrieu, Speaker Johnson, and Steve Scalise. We can't brag about any significant investments. We have not tapped into our relationships. That changes once I'm elected, so the budget looks different. But, you know, St. George does add a huge wrinkle in that we're looking at a $50 million hole in the city parish government. I feel very confident that I can go to the Capitol and to D.C. and pull down additional resources to help mitigate that hole.
We'll be back and spend more time with Ted James on Talk Louisiana after this 89.3 second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. 43-year-old Edward Ted James, a decade in the Louisiana legislature, and then more than 2 years with the, well, right at 2 years with the U.S. Small Business Administration as a regional administrator, and we're going to the phone lines, and we do have people lined up to talk with Ted, so I would ask that you make your remarks brief. But you and the vice president, now the Democratic nominee to be Kamala Harris, are very close, and I'm sure you're pleased with her campaign, but is there any chance that you might get a call from Washington saying, Ted, come to the White House with me?
I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. I am committed to being the mayor of East Baton Rouge Parish. I will be calling the White House in terms of the infrastructure investments that I know we need here, right? When we look at our stormwater management plan, we have punted that over and over. We know that we are in need of legitimate investments in terms of how do we plan against future storms, right? Plan against future flooding in terms of infrastructure. We have not done it. We've studied the issue. Once elected, I'm going to work with the council and the stakeholders for us to ensure that we have the significant investments to protect us against future floodings. I'm also going to work with the federal delegation. You know, if a natural disaster comes, we remember the flood of 2016, how long it took us to get aid. A mayor president with a direct line to the White House helps us in terms of getting resources to the city and the citizens of East Baton Rouge Parish, both Democrats and Republicans alike. Now, I know that some of my, you know, supporters on the south end of the parish, I want you all to focus on what it means for investments in this parish for our mayor to have not only a direct line with the president, but also if the Republicans keep the House, I serve with Speaker Mike Johnson, right? So relationships on both sides. I'm the only person in this race that can speak to the personal relationships that will mean
did
millions
in
investment.
Did you like Mike Johnson?
I like Mike Johnson. I didn't agree with him a lot, but I liked him, right? Okay. We sat next to each other in the Judiciary Committee. He's a very good lawyer, and he was a strong legislator, and he's someone that I worked with at the SBA. I reached out to the speaker even before he was a speaker the moment that I received the appointment. Mm-hmm. Congressman Scalise as well.
All right.
Right. We have those relationships, and they will bode well for us as a parish.
And, of course, we will endeavor to have the mayor on a few times before the election as well. And I spoke with her communications person, Mark Armstrong, yesterday, and I'm sure she will be in studio as well. But Ted James has the floor. We do ask that you keep your remarks as brief as possible. We start with Peter in the Garden District. Peter, good morning. You're on with Ted.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Happy to hear you on the show this morning. And I just had a quick question about, I feel like in the last 20 to 30 years, there's been a lot of kind of short-sighted development in Baton Rouge when it comes to kind of sprawl and so on. So I was wondering what your administration's approach would be to resolving kind of the traffic issues and transportation issues.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, I agree. We've had not a real plan in terms of development. We are in silos in several different capacities as a parish. For us, we have organizations like CPEX. We have organizations like the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, and there are several different infrastructure leaning groups that I work with in the legislature. We have to have a parish-wide plan for alleviating traffic in East Baton Rouge Parish. We have to look at the pockets of success that we've seen across the parish and find out how we can expand those things. The Move Baton Rouge program, that's a program that, in my opinion, is not moving as fast as I would like. Now, of course, those are significant challenges, but I'm not going to run away from challenges. I'm actually run towards those challenges to alleviate the backlog of projects to take a lot of the traffic off the interstate, right? We don't do that unless and until we are alleviating those concerns on surface streets.
Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, you're on with Ted James. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. James, I was just calling. My leadership tells me that you are very anti-union, very anti-police union, and you've roamed the halls of the legislature talking, I'm going to get the unions. I'm going to get the unions.
Is there any validity to that?
That's absolutely false. Now, I have led the charge on police reform, and I've worked well with law enforcement across the board as the chairman of the Criminal Justice Committee. Now, when this community was on the brink of chaos in 2016, not only did I stand on the streets between law enforcement officers and protesters, I took the concerns of protesters and passed policy, but I also did that working with law enforcement. Now, did the police union and I agree on everything? Absolutely not. Did I work with them to compromise without compromising myself? Yes. Now, reform isn't easy. Change isn't easy. And I'm not going to run away from those things because certain people take issue with them. But I know that I have a track record of being able to work with any and everyone. And quite to the contrary, I have been, you know, applauded by the AFL-CIO for my work with working people. So there's nothing anti-union about Ted James or anti-police.
Patricia in Magnolia Woods. Hello, Patricia. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Thanks. I'm a voter, and you've talked about some information about your infrastructure plans. I was wondering if you can give some details about another important priority that you would have. Thanks.
Yes, thanks, Patricia. That's my mother's name. For me, I'm going to really focus on building up our small business ecosystem here, utilizing on my experience with the SBA. Now, we have to address certain issues in terms of capital for small businesses, right? We are going to pull some of the ideas that I work with across the country, like San Antonio, for one. San Antonio created a very strong ecosystem by addressing technical assistance capital, but also they have a very strong approach to empowering small businesses to take advantage of procurement opportunities. I envision working with BRAC and Employ BR because mm-hmm. what we need to do in this parish is merge our workforce and our economic development efforts like similar situated cities. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be necessary in order for us to build up a stronger small business ecosystem.
Kelly Hurtado asks your plan for stormwater management.
Hi, Kelly. We mentioned it briefly. We know that this council has not taken the steps to make sure that we make critical investments. We've had conversations versus a tax versus a fee. My research tells me that if we go the fee route, it will allow us to take advantage of federal grants and to be able to pull down the necessary funding that we need to address this problem, an age-old problem that we are continuing to ignore. The state of Louisiana is number one for rainfall, right? When we look mm-hmm. at DPW, so when we talk about whole-of-government approaches, not just making sure that we have a system, but we fund it. It has to be funded with not one-time money, it has to be funded with recurring dollars so that we can keep our community flood-free. We also have to realign services at DPW. When we look at litter, cutting the grass, I walk the lakes every day, and I see the grass being cut, and it pains me when I see people sweeping the grass in the drains. People, that doesn't help us, right? It doesn't help us when we do that. Getting the necessary infrastructure in place by way of a system funding it and then aligning DPW, I believe that we can rid ourselves of the problem that we know is coming to Baton Rouge with flooding.
Patrick in Innisfil States. Hello, Patrick. You're on.
Hey, Ted, I commend you for, I'm with you. I support the police, but I think the police union in the past was corrupt, and definitely we had instances of police brutality, so I'm okay with that. I guess my question is, the same people that supported Tara Wicker years ago, like the St. George movement, I guess St. George is going to happen, but I heard that you're getting a lot of money from the supporters of the city of St. George.
Is that true?
I'm getting money from people all across the East Baton Rouge Parish, right? The mayor and her team want to focus on a couple of donors. The truth of the matter is I have received significant support from those that funded the anti-St. George movement. Mm-hmm. My support is not based on St. George. It's based on the leadership that I intend to bring to the entire parish. I will invite you and others, Patrick, to take a look at both financial disclosure reports, and I'll tell you that people are supporting Ted James because they are making an investment in my vision. It is not me investing in their vision for this parish. And we are excited about the fact that
we have to take a break, but we'll be back for 3 more minutes with Ted. This is Jim Inkster. We're wrapping it up with Edward Ted James, 43 years young, running for mayor president of East Baton Rouge Parish, the election 12 weeks from today. Same day as the presidential election. Last time in 2020, there was a 70.4% turnout in East Baton Rouge Parish. Joe Biden got 56% of the votes in East Baton Rouge Parish on that day. And then in the runoff, in which Mayor Broome beat Steve Carter, 57-43%, the turnout was 34%. So you can see how the dynamics change dramatically if there is a runoff, and there quite likely will be. Just a few more minutes with Ted James. A listener asked about something that I meant to mention. There is a meeting of Democrats tonight. Are they going to endorse a candidate?
I certainly hope that they do, and I certainly hope to secure that endorsement. I have a very strong record of service in this community, and one that is intentional on this entire parish, from the city of Baton Rouge that raised me, but also Baker Zachary Central and our newest city of St. George. And I look forward to discussing in detail my plans with the folks in my party and hopefully earning their support.
Last caller for Ted James today, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on. Please be brief, Phil. Phil?
Yes, sir. Good morning. Are you going to take money from Exxon or the NRA?
I heard Exxon, but
or the NRA.
I doubt that the NRA is going to support me. But let's talk about the support that I have received. Right, my campaign, we received over 1,000 donations, half of which are under $200. Like, make no mistake about it, my campaign is a grassroots campaign, powered by small dollar donations. And that means something to me when everyday people are willing to invest in our campaign. It tells me that they are hopeful in a new Baton Rouge, and they agree that it's time for change, but they also agree with our vision for economic empowerment, revitalizing our community. And one of the things that we're really intentional on is reversing the trend in East Baton Rouge Parish. We've sent so much money back to HUD. When housing is an issue and homelessness is an issue, and we continue to send our tax dollars back to other communities, that changes once you elect me as your mayor president.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
Sure we'll be talking, and of course, we look forward to hearing from the mayor and the other three candidates in the race as well. And there will be several debates, so that's good. It's always good for public discourse. And in studio is Piper Hutchinson, one of the top reporters in Louisiana, works for the Louisiana Illuminator, and she's been covering higher ed and has many stories that are either first out in the Illuminator or the only place where you read about them. And we just completed the Olympics, and President Bill Tate, who at one time was considered to be one of the foremost authorities on DEI in the country, he's kind of getting in there on the other side, isn't he? What's going on?
Well, thanks for having me, Jim. Yes, as is prone to happen with any big event, there were some viral pieces of misinformation during the Olympics, one of which was about an Algerian boxer, Iman Khalif, who many people accused, as if that's the appropriate word, of being transgender. This was a viral piece of misinformation that took off across the right-wing internet. Lots of, you know, alt-right accounts were sharing it, and ultra-conservative politicians, too. I think it surprised a lot of people when the president of a major research institution chimed in and claimed that this competition would have been illegal in Louisiana. Now, this was a competition between two cisgendered women, so it would not be illegal in Louisiana.
And the president kind of backed away from that, didn't he? A little bit?
A little bit. He, you know, he said he was wrong that it would have been illegal in Louisiana, but he left his post up. I checked as of this morning. It's still up. And he didn't apologize for insinuating untrue things about this woman's mm-hmm. gender.
And this is the same president, of course, who changed DEI to the Office of Engagement at LSU, right?
Dr. Tate, he championed the creation of this DEI office, and then this year he abandoned it. He changed the name. Some people speculated, you know, the timing. The name change was just, one business day before Governor Landry's inauguration, and some people are speculating that these comments are to, you know, make himself more appealing to the governor.
Well, I've seen President Tate change on the dime, and one of them was the Dale Brown Court. He was all for it until John Bel Edwards told him to be against it and make it the Sue Gunner Dale Brown Court. And, of course, Tate did exactly what the governor told him to do, and some people say that's just smart politics. So now he's doing exactly what the governor tells him to do, and the governor happens to be a new sheriff with a different mousetrap. So President Tate, he's laughing all the way to the bank. He, according to your reporting, and by the way, this is the only place I've seen this, he stands to double his $750,000 base salary. What is going on here?
So when the Board of Supervisors gave Tate a contract extension in their last meeting in June, they announced that he would have these incentives to increase his pay. It took me a little while to get a hold of the contract. It was just finalized on Friday. And the contract includes these major incentives through which he can add $650,000 to his compensation if he meets certain goals.
That are very reachable.
Some of them are very reachable, yes. You know, one of them I noted was that if the first to second year retention is 84% in Baton Rouge, well, most recent data is available 2 years ago is 83%.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Now, a listener, this is our friend Hal in Monroe, says that puts him at $1.4 million. That would make him, according to Hal, and I think Hal is correct, one of the highest paid public education officials in the country.
It's a very competitive salary. You know, to put that number in context, that's about the combined salary of the president of the University of Georgia and the University of Georgia system. Now, the University of
Combined salary.
Now, the University of Georgia system is a lot bigger than the LSU system, and Georgia is a wealthier state than Louisiana.
It is, and a bigger state, and yeah. But Bill Tate has played his cards right so far, but LSU president is a political job, and when I make these statements about the president playing politics, well, people say you got to do that. One of my dear friends, the late great James Wharton, he played politics and got burned. After 8 years, he lost his gig. But William Tate is approaching his mid-60s. This is probably his last gig, and I think he wants to keep it. Anything wrong with that?
You know, I don't think it's unusual for higher education presidents to play politics. You know, he's certainly not the only one prowling the halls at the legislature. You know, when Jim Henderson was president of the UL system, he was there every single day. So I think that's just part of the job.
And he got more money for the Louisiana system than Tate got for the LSU system, too.
He played the game well.
And of course, Henderson was the choice of Cleo Fields to be president of LSU. But the aforementioned Collis Temple and Robert Danf, who's no longer on the board, they pushed hard for Tate, and they got him through. And he's a qualified man. He's a brilliant scholar. But it is ironic that his scholarship's largely based on diversity, equity, and inclusion.
He was the premier critical race theory scholar. And
that's right, the premier critical race theory scholar in the U.S. And now he's the head of a university with a complicated past when it comes to race.
It certainly is. I mean, LSU sits on top of former slave plantations and a long and complicated history with desegregation, many buildings named after problematic figures like the Parker Coliseum, which was named after a governor who participated in a mass lynching.
Okay, 877-217-5757. I did not know that about the governor you're mentioning. You're talking about Lesh? That's a story, I think, for another day. But if you want to expound upon it, go ahead.
It's an interesting moment in Louisiana history, a mass, event in New Orleans. But I would encourage you.
Well, but they found one bad letter, and it was a horrible letter, a terrible letter that General Middleton wrote, and he had his name taken off the library. And he was a guy who fought heroically for the U.S. in two wars, changed his position on race as he aged, and yet he's off the library, and they have segregationists and Confederates, and they're still going strong. John James Audubon, David Boyd, it's a case in which some would say a double standard, Piper.
Middleton, yeah, he was the only name to be removed. Maybe he made the sacred sin of saying the football team should still be segregated.
As he was walking out the door in a letter to the guy at the University of Texas who was trying to find a way to do it, but anyway. We got to be brief, but Mike on Perkins, I know you've been waiting a little while. Mike, you're on with Piper. Good morning.
Thank you, Jim. I just want to say this isn't the first time he's played politics and been a little tricky. Piper, can you talk about your reporting on the paid family leave?
So when Governor John Bel Edwards announced the paid parental leave policy for unclassified state workers, there was pressure on higher education to adopt similar policies because they weren't under that policy. And that is something that most institutions have since done. At LSU, it was a little unusual. They announced shortly after Governor Edwards' announcement that they were going to be offering this same policy starting January 1 of this year. And several people were denied that leave, and it turned out that the policy had not yet been finalized for several months after that. That got some faculty and some staff upset, but since then LSU has retroactively applied the policy back to January 1 of this year.
And another listener notes that President Tate and all future presidents, they will have a new house to live in. The president's moved on Lakeshore Drive from one house to another, hasn't he?
That's right. It's a beautiful new house worth about $2 million that the LSU Foundation acquired earlier this year. It might still be undergoing renovations. You can drive by it sometimes and see the work.
Well, he's a neighbor of Brian Kelly, who's the highest paid public official in Louisiana, and Tate will be right there, pretty close, not quite. Almost makes as much as the athletic director, but not quite if he reaches all of his incentives. But Piper, keep talking, keep working, and you're doing great work covering higher education in Louisiana. From the Louisiana Illuminator, Piper Hutchinson.
Thank you, Jim.
See you soon. Back with Phil Price after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're going to spend a few minutes with Phil Price, the noted lawyer, native of Newellton, Louisiana, where his dad was mayor for about three decades. And Phil went off to Georgetown, also educated at LSU, and he came back home and has been one of the top lawyers in Baton Rouge, and in 1995 ran an exceptional race for governor. In a week out, he was within striking distance of making a runoff, and he has that as a memory of 29 years ago. But for the last 15 years, he's been battling to try to get money back from the losses suffered by people who invested with the Stanford Group, which had a big presence in Baton Rouge. Robert Allen Stanford went to jail. He's still there, embezzling money in the billions from his clients. And the people who invested with them for a while, they were on paper getting huge returns, and then they realized it was a Ponzi scheme, and it was gone. And there were others who some might view as being complicit, and that's why there was a case. And Phil Price filed suit against the state of Louisiana on behalf of his clients, the plaintiff's lead attorney. And now a jury has awarded nothing to the people who lost $400 million here in East Baton Rouge and surrounding areas. Phil Price, I know based on your impassioned appearance on this show before the trial, this is a setback, to say the least. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Jim, to say the least, we were stunned. I mean, I don't believe I've ever been that stunned in my life, given the compelling evidence that we put on at trial there. If you recall, the last time I was on the show, I couldn't talk to you about what our evidence was, but after I left the show, the Louisiana Supreme Court ruled that it would be a public trial and all the evidence would now be made available. So in this case, we were very successful in putting on the evidence. The primary issue in the case was whether OFI between 2001 and 2007 knew that things were not right and allowed these people to invest in the SIBCDs. And the evidence was uncontested that in 2004, former Commissioner John Travis said that these SIBCDs were unsafe and unsound. So in the defense of the case, OFI argued, well, that only applies to banks. It doesn't apply to these innocent retirees that are in Zachary, Baker, and Central. And to be quite honest with you, we thought that was a smoking gun document, and it was inevitable that the jury would say, look, OFI knew in 2004, 3 years before our clients invested in the CDs, that they were unsafe and unsound and should have prevented that from happening. Well, the jury didn't see it that way, and it was quite surprising to us.
Now, there was a COVID outbreak, I know, with the jury. Did this create any problems?
You know, when this happened, you're sitting there saying, well, it doesn't look like these people are going to get justice again, because we were afraid that COVID was going to wipe out the entire jury. This happened a week ago on Monday, and these people had been in a very small jury room with no windows for 2 weeks. And, you know, due to certain fortuitous events, they had been there probably about half the time. So we walk in there on Monday, and the judge informs us that there's been a COVID breakout and two people were testing positive for COVID. Well, that didn't end it. The judge felt that he had to have the other members tested and call the jury back in and ask them to be tested for COVID, which obviously presented issues in and of itself. But in hindsight, he had to do it. And one of the jurors, which ended up being on the jury that rendered the final verdict, was forcibly removed from the courthouse by two sheriff deputies because he refused to be tested. So,
oh my goodness.
So I think what I saw was there was an entire sideshow on the whole issue of COVID, and some of these people that were, you know, my age and a little bit younger, I think became more concerned about having to stay on the jury than it did rendering justice to the class victims. I can tell you this, I was blown away, but I don't believe this jury had one bit of compassion for these victims. And particularly during the last days of trial, we had 50 to 60 victims there every day.
What are your next steps, if any?
Well, we're going to file what's called a judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, in a new trial. And generally, those are very difficult to get. But I do think that Don Johnson, who was the presiding judge on this, understands exactly the facts. I think that he was probably stunned with the result, too. I have the highest compliments for Don Johnson on this case. He was accessible. He did a good job of ruling on the issues and was highly organized. And it was really one of the funnest trials I've ever tried in 48 years, even though I lost just because of the way that he ran the trial. Yeah, and his staff was very accomplished.
He's a solid, solid guy in the courtroom. Now, Michael Victorian, he's riding the crest of a wave. He won in the Sharon Lewis case for LSU, and now he's won for the state of Louisiana against these victims of the Stanford group. So sometimes lawyers, they end up not liking each other a lot after a trial. Your thoughts about Mr. Victorian?
Oh, I like Michael Victorian. That was one of the high points of this trial, and even though they prevailed in this case, you know, he's a first-class guy. You know, he's head of 100 black men here in Baton Rouge.
I know.
He's really a good guy. But let me tell you something. you got to get up every morning and be proud of who you represent. And I could have never, and I mean never, represented the state of Louisiana against these innocent victims. And I'm sure that even though it was a victory, it was a hell of a lot easier to represent the state of Louisiana in a case like this than it was to represent my class members. And like I said, even though we lost at this stage of it, it was the finest group of people I ever represented.
Well, we appreciate your passion, and know this has been a 15-year endeavor for you, and it will continue, but this was a big setback. But Phil, we'll be calling again soon about any number of topics. You're one of our faves and a guy who cares about our state. Philip Price from Tensaw Parish, Newlton, Louisiana. One of the great hamlets on Highway 65 leading from Baton Rouge to Little Rock. I've probably driven that about 500 or 600 times over the course of my life. But
oh, that's a great place. It's a great place. I've got carte blanche authority now to go back up there and
well,
sit on the banks of Lake Bruin now that I've completed this task.
And one of my favorite people was from Newlton. You knew him, C.B. Forgotston.
Oh, man, C.B. was a great guy.
He sure was.
Was right across the street.
Well, thank you, my friend. Keep going. You inspire me.
Thank you, Jim.
On another matter involving finances, Louisiana Treasurer John Fleming says he is rejecting the Bank of America's application to serve as one of the state's dozens of fiscal agents, accusing the bank of discrimination and citing its environmental, social, and governance policies. In a statement, Fleming says the decision was made because there is evidence that Bank of America is denying banking services to customers and potential customers of religious organizations, gun manufacturers, and fossil fuel producers based on political perspectives. And it is an interesting move by the treasurer, who was the deputy chief of staff to Donald John Trump in his first term. He was on our show when he was running for treasurer. He said his office was 4 feet away, 4 feet from Donald Trump. So he and former President Trump are friends. Fleming's almost as old as Trump, but he looks 25 years younger. I don't know what this man's doing, but he is in fantastic physical condition, unlike the former president, and he looks like he's 45, and he's in his mid-70s. But he's made a decision here, and last week his top aide, Woody Jenkins, resigned as a communications director at Treasury and has been replaced by another well-known conservative, Jeff Cruer, the Politics with a Punch guy, a talk show host in New Orleans on WGSO. He's now the communications director for John Fleming and put out the press release about this decision from Fleming. This is not just some casual player in the financial industry. It's the Bank of America, but it is interesting. We have a few minutes, Robin. I know we've got some people who have been waiting to talk and probably about various topics. And if you'd like to get in, we'll do our best. 877-217-5757. Who do I go to? She's going to Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. To show you how extreme the Republicans are, a member of the St. Tammany School Board, a Republican, and a member of the State Party Republican Central Committee, said on that crazy talk show in New Orleans a short time ago, so what if climate change destroys the world and the human race goes away? It'll probably come back. Now, those are the words of an insane human being.
Which talk show are you referring to? Which talk show?
I'm talking to that WGSO in New Orleans.
Oh, you're talking about Cruer's show?
Yes, and I have Jeff Cruer on tape, the former executive director of the Republican Party in Louisiana, saying he opposes forced integration. The words of David Duke.
Okay, well, David in Atlanta, thanks for chiming in. Of course, I've always had a cordial relationship with Mr. Cruer. I've been part of his Politics with a Punch. Of course, there is no punching. It's just talking. It'd be more interesting if there really was punching, but there isn't. But he is a guy who has an opinion, and certainly we invite him to be on the show and to counter anything that was said about him today by David or me or anyone else. But it is interesting that he is now the communications director for State Treasurer John Fleming. We're 12 weeks from the presidential election, 84 short days away.
Play WRKF.
Well, and one of the stories of the day is that Willie Brown, the former San Francisco leader, was said to have been on a helicopter with Donald Trump by Mr. Trump himself, and it turns out Willie Brown was never on a helicopter with Donald Trump. It was another African-American official from California, and so Trump and now knows what it's like to have misidentification, and sometimes that's an issue, isn't it? Back tomorrow. Stay safe, stay tuned.